you going between now and vodka o'clock? For me, it's coffee. But I don't settle for mediocre coffee. No, I will not be fooled by the soulless imitation that some companies pass off as the real thing. I drink Sparkplug coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. Therefore, blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this coffee to you in Canada and the U.S. within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto, so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. And you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or you can join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club. It's not a coffee of the month club, it's completely flexible and customizable, all the convenience, none of the commitment. And if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug will give you 20% off your next coffee order. Don't settle for the doppelgangers, plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
I could really use some coffee. Maybe some water and some lozenges. Had to speak more than a few times in decades.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hello, readers of Jeremiah 11:11, and thank you for downloading the 365th Ellis's Analysis. We gaze at movies, usually from long ago, not today though, and we spoil them completely. This Hall of Mirrors started in March 2013 when we set out to review each of the 123 AFI classics on their 1998 and 2007 lists of great movies. Go back years on this channel to find those chats, every single one of them. Now we pick apart flicks that compel us to do some picking. I'm the quirky youngster in the Jaws t-shirt. Never had a Jaws t-shirt. Why didn't I have a Jaws t-shirt? Holding your hand through this venture, Ryan Ellis. And here is the scissors-wielding ballerina who improbably survives on rabbit meat and doesn't struggle to speak.
My wife, Beth!
That's me. And for the record, I tried to find you a Jaws t-shirt once, shortly after the last Tragically Hip concert, a reference that will only go over with our Canadian listeners. And they were outrageously expensive and very hard to find.
Okay. It's okay. I don't have to wear a Jaws t-shirt. I have a Jaws shrine to my right and your left over there above the dresser. By the way, I said this is the 365th podcast you and I have done in total. That means we now have a podcast for every day of the year.
We do.
Plus there's Brightburn that I did. So there's really more than 365. But between you and I, and of course now Scoring at the Movies is not on this channel anymore, so it is 365. It was well over 400 podcasts for a while there when Chris and I still had episodes. But now you have to go over to Scoring at the Movies and your regular podcast places to find all those episodes about Field of Dreams, Jerry Maguire, Hoosiers, all those great sports films. All right, the coming attractions opinion question for this week's picture.
Us!
Lupita Nyong'o was robbed of an Oscar for her stellar work playing two totally different characters in Us. The year before, the Best Actress winner should have been Toni Collette in Hereditary, but she didn't get nominated either. So which Oscar snub do you think was the most egregious ever?
I really thought about this, and I really tried to find something other than Toni Collette, because you said it. But I feel like it would be against type for me to argue for anything other than Toni Collette for Hereditary. And actually Hereditary in general. Oh, you know what? Alex Wolff, too, from Hereditary. There, I'll say that. Two of the best performances of that year. And I think because horror is not a very respected genre, even though the best movies of this decade have been horror movies. That's why they got ignored.
I'll go back further for a lot of my mentions here. I have a lot of things I want to mention before I get to my, well, group of combined people that were ignored. But Denzel Washington in Malcolm X, Al Pacino in the Godfather films, especially the first or second
one. Well, he was nominated. I thought you were going for people who weren't even nominated.
No, I meant that they didn't win.
Oh.
Okay, fair enough. But then again, we're already saying
then,
that.
Then it's Brokeback Mountain.
Ding, ding,
Crash
ding,
winning over Brokeback ding, Mountain. That is ding, the Oscar's ding, biggest crime in modern history.
Ding, ding, ding. Well, we covered that a few years ago. I knew I raved about it. Not as much as you, but I think I'd rave about it more now. That's lived in my memory quite well, yeah. Okay, I'm going to say Citizen Kane. First of the list, didn't win Best Picture, but it was nominated at least, like you just said a second ago. Anthony Perkins and Psycho. But the biggest snub ever, I think, is a tie between Welles, Chaplin, Hitchcock, Kubrick, Altman, and just about every foreign director not named Bong Joon-ho, because none of them ever won Best Director. Some of them won Oscars, like Kubrick did for special effects, and Welles won for writing Citizen Kane. Chaplin won an honorary award. Altman won an honorary award, but never for Best Director.
fact that Hitchcock never won an Oscar, when I always think of Hitchcock films as being very awards friendly. The critics always loved him. He was always a darling, right? And popular as well. Made popular films.
He was a popcorn filmmaker, so I'm not so sure he was that well respected in his day. I think it's more retrospect. Look at Vertigo.
Sure, but Spielberg is our generation's Hitchcock, and how many Oscars does he have? You would know the answer.
Three.
I genuinely don't. Three.
And
for directing?
Nominated, yeah. Well, for directing, it's two.
Two, okay.
Directing and producing Schindler's List and directing Saving Private Ryan, nominations constantly.
I guess in fairness, those are two of his most serious films, mm-hmm. whereas Hitchcock never made Schindler's List. He never made a Saving Private Ryan.
When you Google the biggest snubs of all time, E.T. nearly tops the list, or at least comes close to the top of those lists as Best Picture. They didn't really talk about things like Spielberg winning for Best Director, but for Best Picture, that's what a lot of people would say was one of the biggest snubs ever.
R.I.P. to the Cracked podcast, who always worked with the theory that Oscars should be held 5 years after. This year, we should be giving Oscars to the films of 2015 because it actually takes years to get the hindsight to understand which films were actually the best films of that year and which films you just had a great theater experience or really hit the spot at the moment. You need to see what you still care about years later to really understand whether a film is great or not. The Oscars were in the news a lot this week because they're talking about whether or not they're just going to flat out cancel them this year, how they're going to get around the fact that a fraction of movies were even released this year.
Our Oscar show this year was the longest one ever. Our Oscars preview show was our longest episode ever. Next year, it might be one of our shortest episodes ever.
I know. What's going to be nominated for Best Picture? It's going to be like that Adam Sandler Halloween movie.
Hubie Halloween.
Hubie Halloween.
Well, one of the stars of this movie is in one of the best movies that we've seen so far this year. In the theater, in fact, the last thing we saw before the shutdown happened in March, The Invisible Man, starring Elizabeth Moss, who is in this film. But yes, Lupita should have been nominated, and I think should have even won the Oscar, but
who
wasn't
did win
at the
Best
show.
Actress?
Renee Zellweger for playing Judy Garland in Judy.
I do think that was an exceptional performance, but 5 years from now, what are we going to remember? We're going to remember Lupita Nyong'o making an absolutely legendary villain.
I think so. The duality.
And interchangeable. In
I said Anthony Perkins, and one of the reasons why is because he's got to play this nice guy the whole film, and then you realize at the end, he killed many people. We saw one for sure, but he killed many people, but we didn't know that until the end. Of course, when you watch Psycho in the modern era, you probably know the twist, but the first time you see it, it really colors the whole film and changes everything and makes that performance richer, as this one does. Okay. Us was released by Universal on March 22nd, 2019. They didn't sink much money into making it, so the return on investment was obscenely good. It had a $94 million opening weekend, in fact. I think maybe Jordan Peele has the market covered on February and March releases of pseudo-horror film, thrillers, I guess, almost comedy in some ways. Get Out was nominated for the Golden Globe comedy. That was so dumb. But
yes.
Anyway, that was a comedy of a sort, I guess, because Jordan Peele directed it. But anyway,
it had one funny character in it.
Yeah, he was really funny. But both of those movies were huge hits, and Us, I think, even more so than Get Out. All right, Bev, remind people what this year-and-a-half-old movie is about with the skinny.
Lupita Nyong'o is Adelaide Wilson, a mom on a beach vacation with her family at the site of a childhood trauma that haunts her. The family gets attacked in their beach house by an eerie set of doppelgangers who describe themselves as the Tethered, the shadows of the Wilson family. The family escapes only to learn that every American is being attacked by their own doppelgangers, and they have to find some way to kill their tormentors and find somewhere safe.
Or, in a nutshell, none of these Tethered are social distancing. That is unacceptable. My original nutshell was family goes to the beach, don't like what they see there, and go home. Or at least leave. I've done that one before, though. Somebody sees something bad, and they leave the area. So, the numbers on Us. Rotten Tomatoes critics, 93% of them like this film. 495 fresh, only 38 rotten, for an average of 7.9 out of 10. But only 59% of audiences. That is not a fresh tomato from the audiences. 34% difference between the critics and audiences. I don't know if I've reported a score like that in quite a while. And when I do, it's usually the audiences love a movie, but the critics hate the movie. Maybe Saw, for example, last year might have been like that. I don't remember. I don't get it, especially when I just said a minute ago, this movie was a blockbuster. I'm sure because partly it was Jordan Peele's follow-up to his previous movie. But it's not like the cast were big stars exactly, so it's pretty much Jordan Peele and certainly a good trailer, killer hook. But I don't know why they don't think this movie's at least worthy of a thumb up. Is it as good as Get Out or a lot of other horror films? No. But is it bad enough to get 59%? I don't understand that.
Comparing it to Get Out isn't even fair. I'm not saying Get Out is a perfect film. It's not. But it struck a nerve. He had such a high standard to meet with his sophomore film.
sophomore.
I'm just surprised that people didn't have enough of a good time in the theater to give it a pass. That is such a dismal rating from audiences.
I know. Surprising, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, the movie was 12th of the 2019 U.S. box office. Avengers Endgame was number one. Lupita Nyong'o was in Star Wars Episode 9. That was number three. And Midsommar was number 86. Also, by the way, her husband in this film, Winston Duke, was in Avengers Endgame, at least briefly. One of the badasses charging Thanos and his army at the end of that movie. We said about the Oscar already. Well, Lupita was at least nominated for a SAG. So that's something. She got the Screen Actors Guild nomination, but not the Oscar nomination. Okay, well, we've now seen Us twice in the theater a year and a half ago and about a week ago. What'd you think of it the second time?
I think Us is great. It's very fun, very watchable. The action set pieces are dynamite. Performances out of this world, we've already said, especially Lupita Nyong'o, who gives us this instant classic villain. But I do have a hair trigger for poorly fleshed out logistics in a film, especially when Us goes so far out of its way to explain why and how all these weird things are happening in a way that just invites us to question the sheer logistics of this possibility. And so, just like the first time I saw it, I very much enjoyed it in the moment, but couldn't help but dwell on all the logic fallacies. This is so much busier than it needs to be. And I think Jordan Peele also just tried to overpack it.
This one more so than Get Out. That was a way more tight film.
Yeah, it's kind of like streamlined. It's an elegant theme, whereas with Us, it seems like he's trying to do a lot of things at once. But I still love it just for the sheer fun of watching it. It is an excellent thriller. One of the reviews I read about it summed it up nicely, where they said, there are few directors who so obviously love movies the way that Jordan Peele does. He just sinks his teeth right into all of those things that film buffs go nuts for. So it really appeals to me on that level.
He and Edgar Wright should hold a film festival together, and Quentin Tarantino should be their sponsor.
It would go all year long.
And then Scorsese as well should be the executive director of the four of them. And you can name a lot of other people that love movies, of course, but movie references in this film are overwhelming, and you should look online for more than we will mention this movie, because there are so many. I like it too. I wouldn't say I was scared by the movie, especially the second time. I'm not so sure that Get Out was actually scary either. What would be the most frightening weird thing? I guess when the family attacks and then they get in the house.
They first get there and they're standing at the end of the driveway and they're backlit. That part's scary. When they first get to the house, I say that's scary. From that point on, it's just more of a thriller than a horror film to me.
But then again, the trailer gives away that, as the kid says, it's us. So if you saw the trailer, you know that somehow it's doppelgangers of them. Of course, you have to watch the movie to know what the real storyline is, that they're tethered and they're clones and all that kind of thing. Let's get this straight right now. So Adelaide, we'll say, is the character that did the switch. She is the one who was the clone, but she's the character we follow through most of the movie. That's the Lupita character who is wearing white, who has a family. That's Adelaide. Red is the real person who was switched.
Mm-hmm.
And who's the real villain? We'll get to that in a second.
Adelaide is the clone.
Red is the person.
The original person.
Right. So this is the movie where the villain wins because the villain has been the hero for decades, has a family, has lived a fairly normal life. But is she the villain? Adelaide screwed over Red with the switch, but she was shit on first. They all were shit on first. We can't include everybody on the planet in this because people who are in jail or being tortured or being raped every day or have absolutely nothing are not included in this. But that still means that probably billions of people on this planet, even the poorest person in Toronto, maybe somebody who is a homeless person, like the Jeremiah 1111 guy, for example, are still better off than the people, well, the clones that are underneath the United States of America in this movie. And they're implying it's just the USA, which is another weird touch because is this anywhere else?
American.
Right.
No, she says, we're Americans.
People point out that us also could be U.S.
Of course.
Period us, United States.
Yeah.
But this is one of those films where we look at it and say, if you're going to be fair, you're going to be woke, you're going to be all the things that everybody tries to be now, this is obviously a metaphor for people to get shit on, but it's black people who are part of the problem too. And Jordan Peele, obviously, in Get Out was sympathetic to his own cause, as he should have been. Most people would understand that. But now it is our main characters who are black. And they didn't do anything on purpose. None of these people did anything on purpose. Even the rich people didn't do anything on purpose, or the well-off people like their friends. But all of us are culpable in the sense that they're coming for us. So we all have to worry about that. Even the homeless guy gets killed, who probably did nothing wrong because he's been homeless for what looks like a long time.
It reminds me a lot of Parasite. The two films bear so many striking similarities.
Also last year.
Even with the upstairs downstairs thing where you have somebody living underground who's this low-key threat that nobody's even aware of. And in both films, we're really invited to consider who the real monster is. The underclass is coming to kill us and take our places, but we're the ones who obliviously benefit from the underclass. We may pay lip service to suffering, but none of us would trade places with them. We wouldn't even, as Red suggests, save them from the underground and share our resources with them. Because one of the things she says to her is, you could have brought me with you. Why did you leave me down here in the tunnels? We could have just both gone above ground. And Adelaide, who starts off the movie, of course, as our heroine, we find out not only does she become a monster to protect her privilege, protect her family, but to protect her privilege that she stole from Red. But we learn that she was a monster to begin with.
But created by the government.
Well, that's just it. Like, she's Frankenstein. Who's the real enemy?
They're all Frankenstein.
Like, you have this class war going on where they turn against each other, but the real enemy is whoever created the Tethered in the first place and then abandoned them to just suffer. And the Tethered is mad at these people who live above ground. They're clones, they're copies that they're shadows of. They aren't to blame. They aren't even aware of it. Mm-hmm. I think the first time I saw it, I took it as a metaphor for not even just the underclass of America. And of course, we're Canadians, but Canadians have a very similar class structure to America. I took it not just as that underclass that we overlook and take advantage of, but even the underclass of all the people in the world who live much less privileged lives, so that we can have cheap clothes and furniture, so that we can have some pretty comfortable, easy lifestyles with just about anything we want at the click of a button. No matter how woke you are, chances are you're still shopping at Amazon, mm-hmm. right? You're still buying products made in Bangladesh. Maybe once a year you might read an article and share it on Facebook and get outraged about it, but for the most part, we don't think about it. We just don't. There's a level of obliviousness that is so easy to maintain. And I say obliviousness, that's not correct. It's like ignorance. In us, they're truly oblivious. There's no way they could even know about what's going on underneath of them. Except that Adelaide obviously does know. It's so interesting watching this a second time and watching the way that she is so anxious that they're going to the beach. And you get the impression she's always anxious to go there, but this year she knows something's up because she has this connection. She probably is more connected to Red because Red was the human. So she probably has a closer kind of link to her. She knows that something's up. And you might even wonder if them going to the beach house in a way triggers the revolution.
I think it's saying that.
Yeah, because her just going to that vicinity, because she'll go there to meet her. She has to because she's tethered. But that gives her access to that tunnel. Because they're in the same part of America.
The question becomes, why do they go there at all? But I think it's because this was her family's beach house. And if she says, no, I'm not going up there. Maybe she's done that before and for good reason. Well, claimed it was good reason. The kids are sick. I feel sick this summer. Let's do something else. But maybe it's been 3 or 4 years. And he says, we have this great beach house in Santa Cruz, which, by the way, is about an hour and a half from San Francisco. I looked it up. Let's go there once in a while. It's free. It's your family's beach house. Why are we never going there? And she finally has no choice but to go. Then, of course, you could ask the question, why does she go to the beach itself? Well, again, unless she admits to her husband why she's not going. But the bigger reason is, it's the Hitchcock answer. Because if she doesn't, there's no movie. Although, then again, them going to the beach doesn't really mean anything. Jason sees the Jeremiah 1111 guy who's been swapped out. So the real person's dead. Now this is the clone. The first one waiting on the beach for the Hands Across America pose. But it isn't implied that Jason and Pluto switch. Obviously not, because Pluto was burned and Jason wasn't. But Jason seems like he maybe saw something, but then he may have just seen the Jeremiah 1111 guy. We don't know what else happened in his little encounter when he went off by himself, much like Adelaide did when she was a little girl, about the same age. But them just going to that beach house, if they had not even gone to the beach at all, Red's plan would have been started because it was triggered. But really, the real answer for this is you have no movie if they don't go to the beach.
Sure.
If they stay hundreds of miles away, then this is never going to actually happen.
I think it works, though. I don't think that's too forced.
Well, plus this is
a connection with them going to the beach.
This is also, and this is true about so many movies, but this is Plot Holes, the movie.
Truly.
You said Get Out. Get Out actually is way more believable in its sci-fi premise.
It's just less ambitious.
Than this is.
Yeah, so it just kind of is this more straightforward story, whereas Us, how many things did they have to pack in here? You have the initial concept of the doppelgangers living underground. Okay, that's a lot to begin with. And then they had to introduce the Hands Across America and the rabbits and 1111. None of it gets tied up in a neat little package at the end.
Well, it's one of those movies that doesn't have an ending. It's much like The Birds, where you see the Hands Across America thing. is maybe happening across the whole country, but at least in that part of the country, a lot of these tethered have started doing it. It looks like it's many miles worth, and there's helicopters in the air. You can see burning stuff in the background. I don't know where the Wilsons are going to go. Maybe home, but how is that any better? But then this is also a movie, and somebody says this online, about how the tethered only kill their doppelgangers, the real people that are their doppelgangers. But that's not entirely true.
Yeah, no.
Because Umbre attacks the car owner.
That's
when
right.
She's standing on top of the car.
And Elizabeth Moss, she doesn't try to kill Adelaide, although nobody really tries to kill Adelaide.
You mean Dahlia, then, the double.
Right, the double.
The tethered.
Just like Red, she handcuffs her to something instead. It just seems like it's for convenience of the plot to put her in peril and have one of the kids save her. But she does attack her, nevertheless.
Mm-hmm.
I think the twins attack the kids as well.
But it is about torture and revenge for Red as well. That's why the sequence plays out so long when she's explaining everything.
She wants to enjoy it, yes.
She needed it to happen for the plot line. But it does make some sense. And then she sicks the various people on their own. Had Gabe not been a tougher fighter, Abraham may have finished him off awfully fast, but he doesn't. The two kids show great capacity for violence and the ability to kill when they're pushed into a corner, especially the daughter, Shahadi Wright Joseph, who plays Zora, and of course Umbre. She's great as Umbre, especially those eyes.
Oh my God, so sinister. She's outstanding.
Madison Curry as the young Adelaide, young Red with the eyes also, but that's more about terror. That's in the trailer, of course, when she goes in the Hall of Mirrors. The two of them with those eyes, though, man, it's very effective stuff. So we're not really sure what exactly the logic is with who you can attack and what the rules are. But then we've got some reasonably good questions here, and there's probably a dozen of these. I've only got a few I'll mention right now. How did Red communicate her plan to the Tethered? She can speak, although she's not done it in a long time, and you can tell by the voice.
Also, she was choked.
Her vocal cords didn't recover for decades?
I don't know.
I don't know. Also, the door to the underground would have been guarded by the government long ago, but they've abandoned this experiment. The rabbits would multiply by having a lot of sex, and that's fine, I can understand that. But when the door's not guarded, why stay? Now, you could argue the tethered have just assumed that they're being guarded like they were before and don't try to get out.
But maybe they don't even know that they can leave.
Because that's true. They don't have a soul. That's the biggest thing. I mentioned this before. I think I cut this point off earlier. Red tells Adelaide what she knows. But this is one of those movies where I don't think she's lying. Why would she lie to her under those conditions? She's trying to kill her. She's already taken Jason. She wants to finish them all off, but especially Adelaide out of revenge. But she's telling her what she knows, and she may not be right. She's guessing. It's not like the government person in charge said, well, I'm going to tell you everything before I leave here and let you all just fend for yourselves. She may be wrong.
And how would they have told each other that if they don't speak? Then how would those tales have even passed from one generation to the next?
Yeah, and then how do the people know way off from the distance? Maybe in that below ground area in Santa Cruz and even some parts of California, they could pass along information.
But this is all of our drive home nitpicking. Mm. And I think we had this exact conversation after we first saw it. But I want to go back to what you said about how they have no souls. She says they could clone the body, but they couldn't clone the soul. And then she goes on to say, two people share one soul. The movie's clearly showing that the soul isn't determined by birth. The above ground people aren't just granted a soul, and the tethered are never.
Because otherwise, Adelaide could never look
human.
Because Adelaide
clearly has a soul.
Come across human, yeah.
She behaves in a monstrous way at times, for sure. But she's a great mom. She's a great wife.
She seems normal.
She seems very normal and happy, and she's a person with a soul.
Her husband's awesome. He's a cutie. He's fun.
Such a teddy bear.
This is the tough-ass bad guy in Avengers, not even Avengers Endgame so much, but Black Panther.
I love him. He's so lovable. When he's in the boat, all that stuff. He's just so
adorable. Crawdaddy.
Yes.
Should be New Orleans, I guess.
Not as good of a name as Tim Heidecker's boat, Biatch.
All right. Better boat, of course, for a richer person. Yeah.
Ah, great. Another point the film is making, kind of like in Parasite, where they go, oh, for rich people, they're so nice. And the mom says, they're nice because they're rich. Being rich, having all these advantages, makes it easy to be a kind, good person because you don't have to scrabble just to make it.
Tell that to Mitch McConnell. Tell that to Donald Trump.
And it's the same as Adelaide.
Tell that to Mark Zuckerberg.
All right. You've made your point.
That's true. That line applies, and it applies to this movie, too. That's right. And Parasite was also last year. I think you said in our Oscars preview or post-view show, one of those anyway, maybe the end of the year show we did last year, talking about the movies of 2019. A lot of those
class
kinds of movies.
Class war year, because it
Parasite
was
Parasite
and Us. And then there was Knives Out and Hustlers.
Major releases, too, not just some
independent
films. Yes, and
huge hits. All of them were sensations.
But there are some interesting clues with Adelaide. She doesn't eat the fast food they all have when they first got into the beach house. She's eating strawberries. She doesn't drink. Now, she doesn't necessarily have to drink in the mid-afternoon on the beach, but on vacation when her friend's offering her some booze and saying no, it's implying that she doesn't drink booze either, that she just drinks water and eats things like strawberries. I like also the subtext, beyond the subtext, that she doesn't eat meat because she would have had to for however many years it was when she was still a young kid, eating only rabbit, yeah, and raw rabbit at that. And they don't get into this, but maybe they sometimes ate the bodies of the ones that died, the clones, because they may have run into rabbit or wanted something different.
You figured that one out on your own there,
buddy. Of it right now. It's possible, though, right? But then I think the subtext also could be Jordan Peele saying, here's a Hollywood actress, Lupita Nyong'o, very slender. Actresses, actors that don't eat anything.
She was also a ballerina.
Right.
I mean, so she's starving herself. Slim, yeah.
Yeah, starving herself in that kind of way, too, beyond what's going on in the subtext of the movie. It's a subtext on a subtext. And this movie has a lot of subtext, of course, too. The twin subtext is the biggest one because you get the twin Tyler daughters, who actually are twins. Callie and Noelle Sheridan play Becca and Lindsay. And, of course, the two tethers that kill them. Scissors, the gold scissors. Again, where did the gold scissors come from? The jumpsuits, you could argue, were probably given by the government. But why would the scissors be given by the government? And they all seem to have scissors. But okay, fine, we'll let that slide. But scissors themselves, the object, is a twin. It's a mirror image of itself.
Oh, and those scissors are specifically designed for the movie. Unlike most scissors that are for right-handed scissors, one is significantly bigger than the other. These are mirror symmetrical okay, instead, yeah. And they were designed for the movie to be so.
Right. Then the 1111 thing. My friend Mike Stanton, if you ever listen to this podcast, has had that website, 1111, I think, .com. I forget the website name now, forever. But they've been obsessed with seeing the number 1111. And I think it is Jason that notices it. Just points it out, which is what Mike first did with me a long time ago. Just points out, hey, how about that? And that number does come back an awful lot of times. Not just Jeremiah 11:11, the Bible passage, which, by the way, I have right here.
It's so mean.
I will bring on them a disaster they cannot escape. Although they cry out to me, I will not listen to them. I'm not sure. I didn't read further than this because I don't really care, but I'm guessing that has something to do with Noah's Ark story.
Sure.
Many of the Bible stories.
There's so many wrath of God stories in the Bible, but it is a passage about the wrath of God. And 1111 also, you have four digits, the family all standing next to each other, as they do many times in the film. And in all the promotional material, you have the family standing next to each other holding hands. That's 1111, right? It's four.
The
ones.
Shadows going to the beach.
Yep.
Is also that, the 1111 thing. Yeah, sure. And then when they do the Hands Across America thing, it's a lot of 11s, a lot of 1s.
It's all about symmetry, too, right?
And the Hands Across America commercial that we see in the opening, and when I think the TV gets turned off, you do see that it is, well, I guess red, but Adelaide as a human still watching this commercial. So it's implied it's one of the last things she ever saw before she was taken underground and switched. And I think even in the commercial, it says they're tethered together. That didn't mean anything bad, but I guess that's where she gets the phrase tethered from.
Right.
She saw it that day before they went to the boardwalk thing and played games. Her parents did, at least. Her dad playing whack-a-mole. Another thing where something comes from underground, let's whack it down, but it comes up somewhere else.
Oh my God, yes. Jordan Peele is so thoughtful about these things. He doesn't leave a stone unturned when it comes to every single detail in the film having a significance that the more you watch it, the more you get out of it. It's just one of the reasons why I'll never be that bothered by all the plot logic fallacies because it's just such a rich movie to watch that you're like, forget it. I'll forgive all of these things. It's so worth it to watch this man at work. He has such a great imagination and he is in so many ways a great screenwriter, maybe sloppy storyteller, but those little details in the screenplay are so outstanding. In reality, Hands Across America was apparently a huge logistical nightmare, but Adelaide wouldn't have known this, that it kind of was a mess in the end and it ended up being almost impossible to pull off. So much more trouble than it was worth.
Well,
and yes,
she
it raised money.
Because she saw a commercial. She didn't see the actual event yet.
Yeah, and a kid watching that would, of course, be impressed. And before she went underground, that was her impression of an important symbol.
Very positive one,
something,
too.
Something, a positive, meaningful symbol of togetherness. It's also a metaphor that when they come up, they pull off Hands Across America in a way that above-ground Americans never could. So it's a metaphor for the way that the suffering underclass can sometimes be much better at acting together as a whole to accomplish something significant and meaningful They're organized, they're committed, and they'll follow a leader. Yet the privileged above ground, they bicker with one another. They can't accomplish anything as an organized group. And Hands Across America, we remember it because we're old enough.
I don't remember, but actually.
You don't? Oh, I remember
it. I was 12. It was 86, apparently.
That's funny. I didn't
even... Well, the movie's set in 86, so I guess that
happened.
Live
in North America when it happened, but I do remember Hands Across America being a thing. It's funny how it's really been erased from history, partly because it was this pie-in-the-sky idea that didn't pan out the way that they wanted it to. But when the Tethered come out and do it, they do it right.
Well, because if we all actually did this in any country, especially one as big as America...
Traffic and would we're be all... a disaster.
True, that's true too. But I'm just saying that if we all actually united, I've said this in other podcasts before, The Dark Knight Rises gets into this when Bane stokes such problems in Gotham. And that great image of two rich people coming out of their building and being attacked by the underclass. I don't want to see that happen, but you got to wonder if that's maybe going to happen for real. If none of this really changes. And the rich people don't want the rest of us to realize that we shouldn't be disliking somebody who's got the same color skin, or because they're gay, or because they're a woman, or because they're anything like that. Because if we realize those things really shouldn't matter, and you know what? I'm not a dick. I'm going to unite with them. The real problem in the world, for a long time, have been the rich people keeping the rest of us down. They don't want that to happen. So they don't want a Hands Across America thing to ever happen. But it is interesting that this villainous act and the Tether do murder people, and an awful lot of people, obviously. But in the end, it's this message of hope. But then that leads me to what happens next. What does happen next?
Great
so they've
question.
Killed their human counterparts. They've all held hands. Now what?
Do they just take the positions that
Did
they would
they just take
have
over
had?
The human lives? Yeah.
Yeah.
I am now an accountant.
They've only just been doing these crude pantomimes right. of these actions before, so an accountant would sit down and be like, I'm typing at a computer and just mashing the keys and not really know what
but
they're doing.
Mashing now, on them like an actor would in a movie where they're
can't
actually
communicate.
Typing anything.
Can they read and write? We don't even know truly how would they ever make it in the above ground. Mm. Although, I think it's safe to say, because we have Adelaide as an example, they would certainly have a rough go of it at first. But being above ground, having autonomy because they've killed their tethers, so they can just be themselves. They don't have anybody magically, however it works, forcing them to do one thing or another. That freedom, that autonomy is going to eventually evolve into them simply taking the place of everybody. Will the world be a hot mess for a while? Oh, yes. Mm. It is going to be a disaster for a while. But I can totally see how after just a generation... they would just take their place.
Planet of the Apes kind of thing, where it takes a long time, but the apes do learn to be like us. Not that they need to be like us, or the Tethered need to be just like what we do now, but they could be.
But they would at least be above ground. One of the nice things about watching this a second time is Adelaide's fear about going back to the beach. The first time I watched it, I just totally associated it with, well, something traumatic happened to her.
We know it did.
In that Hall of Mirrors. And we don't get to see the whole thing, but we're just led to believe that, wow, whatever happened must have been pretty bad. She doesn't want to go back. But then you realize, oh, no, she's just afraid of getting dragged back underground and going back where she truly belongs, in a sense.
Yeah, that's true. But it's a horrible thought, though, too.
Yeah.
The government's real villains here.
Yeah.
So there's a Trump that was down there all this time coming for him. I'm indestructible. You can't get me. Well, you wouldn't get to the president.
Ew, there's a Tethered Trump.
Tethered McConnell.
Now, Trump must be the Tethered because he definitely has no soul.
Oh, maybe that's
and
it.
And he can barely talk.
Right. Nice. Maybe that's a subtext, too. Well, you see interviews with him long ago, and he said things that seemed pretty reasonable. I'm sure he was always a rapist and always a terrible person and a money grubber and a cheat and a liar.
But he was articulate back then.
Well, maybe not articulate, but he was better than he is now. Mm. But I didn't remember this part about the movie that we find out about the switch after Adelaide and Red have had their confrontation and Red has been killed. So the original clone has won and gotten out of there. But then you see the flashback to the switcheroo, and the person that we've been following this whole movie, our supposed hero, is actually, and again, villain's tough to color that, but she's the one that did the switch move. Jason seems to suspect something. He looks at her. Those two are also connected to the whole film. It's father-daughter, who are connected pretty well, Gabe and Zora, but then it's also Adelaide and Jason seem to be connected quite a bit. And in the last shot, Jason's in the front seat of the ambulance. Adelaide's driving the ambulance with her red hoodie. It was white. It becomes more and
she
more
starts off white. It gets
red from
that's
blood.
True. Yeah,
almost entirely
her.
Red. She's going to try to just live a normal life. She gives him a look. Really well played, too, because it seems sinister. But at the same point, this is the life that she's had for a long time. And this is all Jason and Zora have ever known as a mother. and all Gabe has ever known is a wife. So if they found out who she really was, and why would they? But if they found out who she really was, would they hold that against her? Would they do something about that? Because what do you do? This is what you've always known. It's like if you found out that your spouse, a long time ago, was a terrible bully, or worse, maybe a rapist or a killer. You don't have to forgive them. I understand why someone would say, you can never forgive that. But if you've known them for 20 years or even 50 years, and you find out something that happened before you ever even knew them, something terrible they did a long time ago, especially in this case, when she was a kid, how do you hold it against her the same way? And how do you judge somebody who doesn't? If Jason and Zora and Gabe did find out, if they just go on and say, but you're our mother now. You seem human to me. You seem normal to me. Eat a lot of strawberries rather than fast food and drink a lot of water rather than wine, but you're normal.
All this is
you have no rhythm also, by the way. That's a great touch I didn't pick up until I read online when we saw it the first time, then when she's trying to teach him how to snap and she's off rhythm.
Everything you're saying is reminding me of another movie we've covered. Actually, one of our more popular episodes, History of Violence, which is all about a woman coming to terms with her husband, who's a good man, objectively.
Great man.
But had a pretty messed up past. The internet has really made a meal out of that last scene and the interaction, well, all the interactions between Adelaide and Jason. Obviously, Jason takes after her more. She is just stranger. She is a little bit weird and a little bit awkward. Mm. And Jason is very awkward. Whereas Zora, like you said, she's more like her dad. She takes after her dad. But both Zora and Jason are half tether.
Mm-hmm.
So you could just say he's a little bit more tethered. He's not lacking a soul. I would never use that phrase because I think it's very strongly implied that Jason is a good kid who's just weird. And his sister is so great. She loves him. What does she say about him when they're like, why is your brother so weird? And she's like, it just takes him a while to get used to things. Lay off. Be cool.
He's a kid.
He's a kid, too. Now, he wears that mask through the whole film, which is a Wolfman mask.
Well, people don't say online it's a Chewbacca mask.
Oh, is it? It's a monster mask. I'd say it's a monster mask.
And he pulls it down at the end when he looks at her. They look at each other significantly. That can mean a lot of things, but it seems to mean, all right, let's put our masks back on.
Well, that's just it. Curiously, it's a monster mask. That's his passing as a normal person mask is a monster.
But he couldn't have been switched with Pluto because Pluto is scarred up.
No, it's very obvious.
They probably shouldn't have scarred Pluto because that would have been a whole great little twist on it. If we couldn't be sure if he was the tethered for most of the movie, when he went and saw the Jeremiah guy.
He pulled an Adelaide, mm-hmm. then switched places.
Because the scars, it can't
be. He's about maybe a little older than she was when she switched out, but roughly the same age. But back to the mask. It's the mask that he puts on to be human. It's a barrier that he puts between himself and the world to cope.
Jason Voorhees, Michael Myers do that too?
Yeah, and his clone also does that. Pluto does that.
He's always wearing a mask. Well, we see the face a little bit, but mostly we see the mask.
And you could definitely say that after all that trauma, he would need a little extra coping mechanism. The whole world is messed up. Mm-hmm. So you can see why he might need a little extra. It's a very curious image for Peele to end the film on.
Mm-hmm.
And a suggestion that this isn't a happy ending. I mean, it's not a happy ending anyway. Even in the family alone, maybe the bad guys won. One of the things we've talked about with all the great horror films that have come out in the last decade is that the bad guys keep winning. And movie after movie after movie, the best case scenario is that maybe our heroes survive, but the monster is still alive and coming after somebody.
It Follows is a perfect example of that.
I was just thinking of that. Our heroes survive, but this sinister force is still out there and gonna really hurt people. And all they did was manage to protect themselves. And that's kind of like us as well. All they really managed to do is protect themselves. And Adelaide very much is a person who's been protecting herself all along at the expense of others.
Also, Adelaide probably should worry that even if they thought she was actually their leader all this time, so she was the red, maybe she's going to have to use that voice if she's ever around them. We're really speculating now because we don't know where the movie's going to go, where the story would go after the movie ends. But let's say she tried to lead them after all. But we've seen it all throughout history. In reality, the masses will turn on their leader. It'll be one of those A2 Brutus things, possibly. And they've all got knives because they've all got scissors. So if she does try to lead these millions and millions of tetherds who are across America, or at least starting to be across America, if she doesn't do what they like, for whatever reason, they might turn on her too. As for that Hall of Mirrors thing, that is definitely one of the more creepy moments in the whole film, especially if you don't know much about the story going in. Madison Curry, who's never been in a movie before, this was her debut, has those great eyes, she looks terrified. It reminded me of Casablanca when it's in all the Hall of Mirrors and all the towns and all the wild. Isn't it lucky Adelaide walked into mine? meaning the real Adelaide walked into Red's Hall of Mirrors.
They say several times, they were born special. They have a stronger connection than most, I guess.
When we saw the movie in the theater, I had to go to the washroom during the scene right before the Tylers get attacked by their tethers. Oh,
what so did you think of it now that you finally saw it?
Well, one thing I really took from it, Red is dragging this up because she wants revenge on Adelaide. But she sicks the other three on the three real people in Adelaide's family to take care of the business pretty quickly. But when it comes to the Tylers, it is all business. There's no games.
They don't have a personal vendetta the way Red has
right.
with Adelaide.
Kitty lives longer, maybe because it's Elizabeth Moss and you want her to have a little bit more screen time. Although her tethered is even more effective. She gets to play some great scenes, putting on makeup, cutting her own face, implying the nip and tuck she had. She even talks about that on the beach when she's still just regular Kitty. Elizabeth Moss, about a year later, this year, though, plays a great character in The Invisible Man, last movie we saw before the pandemic really hit and we couldn't go to the movies anymore. We talked about the Oscars. Well, that might be nominated for some. It probably should be nominated for Best Actress. She's great in that film.
And any other year, it wouldn't even have a ghost of a chance. But
well, maybe, except if Lupita doesn't get nominated for Us and Toni Collette and Hereditary, both early year horror films, and now Invisible Man, another year, three straight years like that, probably not. But Moss having contempt... Her? Really? Playing a contemptuous character for her husband, though.
She glowers for a living.
Yeah, she really does, because The Handmaid's Tale, a lot of Mad Men, and she's not really contemptuous in Invisible Man, actually. It's a really nuanced performance and a great one. But her playing a character with hatred in her heart, especially for men, is easy pickings for her.
Yeah.
But when she's playing it as herself, as the human I'm talking about, the tether doesn't count on what I'm saying here now. We don't get a lot of screen time with her as a person. Her tether gets more screen time than she does, I think.
They have a very amusing fight. Tim Heidecker plays her husband. I love him, but I don't think many people really know him for much other than...
Bridesmaids!
Bridesmaids, where he barely has a line.
He's the husband.
So underused. I was so disappointed by that. I was so excited to see him, because I was always a huge fan of Tim and Eric. Anybody who likes editing and comedy, that show is one of the most innovatively edited things in history.
Wasn't Key and so Peele incredible. Also? Key and Peele, of course, Jordan Peele show with Keegan-Michael Key. I never saw
they
either
were
one.
They more like classical. You can tell that Jordan Peele had a love of film because Key and Peele drew a lot of inspiration from movies and they just mimicked these classical styles. Tim and Eric is something completely different. It's actually something brand new that I've never seen before and maybe seen since, but everything is just a copy of what Tim and Eric did. Very Adult Swim. Very weird. I adore him, and I loved every frame he was in this film.
And he gets to play the quirkiest of all the tethereds when he is the tethered version of
Josh. He's like walking around the boat and just talking to himself and being a goof, but in the weird tethered copy version, mm-hmm. wearing that kimono. Loved it.
And the Tylers aren't super rich, but they're certainly better off than the Wilsons are. And the Wilsons are doing pretty well, too. We don't have a beach house we can go to, inheritance or otherwise.
I saw one critic say that one of the subtexts of the film was that the Wilsons are middle-class black people who have forgotten about the black underclass in America. And part of that is illustrated through the beginning when they're listening to that song. Oh, was it called Put Five on It?
In the car where there's no beat?
Yeah,
when Adelaide
so
no
ignorant.
Beat.
The name of the song has escaped me. But Gabe is super into it. And I think it's Adelaide who points out, you know, they're talking about dealing drugs on the corner. What are you relating to about this song? This is so distant from you. And he's just like, shut up, let me enjoy it. That's part of the illustration that they're this middle-class family who has lost touch with the struggle of their people.
Well, it's like I said before on one of our other podcasts about Jennifer Lopez. I'm still Jenny from the block. No, you're not. You're remarkably rich.
Okay, but she's much, much richer than the Wilsons.
Yeah, but I'm still street. No, you're not. And that's not a bad thing. You're not street anymore. Well, talking about class, did you notice that the weapons, for the most part in the movie, are high-class type things, or at least the kinds of things
like
the tethers are
clubs.
Never going to have access to? Baseball bats, golf clubs especially, a boat, whether it be the crappy crawdaddy that Gabe buys, or the better one, the biatch, that Josh has. These are things that poor people forget the tethers. Okay, baseball bat and a golf club, you can get those, but you're not likely to play golf if you're not rich. Baseball, you can, but you're sure as hell not buying a boat if you're not wealthy. And if you're a tethered, forget about any of it. And those are most of the weapons that are used in this movie.
The Wilsons have this underclass shadow of them, but in a way, they're also kind of a shadow of the Tyler family. And the Tyler family has all these things that the Wilson family has, but everything is much nicer. Gabe tries to beat them up with a baseball bat. The Tyler's weapon is a golf club. Gabe has this little motorboat. the Tylers have a yacht. They have this rather humble beach house they inherited. The Tylers have this gorgeous modern mansion beach house that's much nicer. So you have that additional level of a family of four living high. And even more miserable, the Wilsons are a happy family. Mm-hmm. The Tylers are miserable.
Not at all happy.
And they're completely divided. The twins are close, but other than that, the family seems to hate each other. It's like the next tier up.
Tier up. What about tier down? Back to the underground for a second. Where is all the refuse and the crap?
Why is it so clean down there?
And the pee. You watch the movie Blindness, which is not a fun movie, but a well-made movie at least.
I read the book, man, and it's even more gruesome.
It's the Mark Ruffalo, Julianne Moore movie from, I think, 2008. These people are just blind. That's all it is. They otherwise are fully human, unlike the Tethered. But I guess you could argue the Tethered are trained to use the washroom all the time. But then if they're mimicking people above, it's just another plot hole, I guess, in this movie. It doesn't matter. But it is so clean down there.
Yeah, it's spotless. If they're always copying the behavior of the people above ground, when do they have time to skin and eat rabbits? Hmm. Or, yeah, clean the hallways or make clothes that mimic the clothes. There are these shadow versions of the clothes, all those little details.
The same Thriller shirt.
I think it's just supposed to be a little metaphysical. It happens. Don't think too hard about it. Hmm. I do struggle. It's kind of similar to Christopher Nolan films. Well, don't make it so plotty. Don't invite me to think about the logistics when the logistics are as muddy as this.
Yeah.
We talked about how Inception, it's an hour of explaining what's about to happen and then they break all of their own rules. Us kind of has that similar problem. You actually spend a lot of the running time of the film explaining what's going on and why it's happening. Meanwhile, it doesn't really make sense as soon as you think about it for more than a minute.
And the movie's almost 2 hours long and Inception's almost 2.5 hours long. Both of them are probably too long, especially Us, for what their concept is. Us is an hour and a half movie in a 2 hour package. I'm thinking about Groundhog Day right now. They were going to explain why Phil is experiencing this over and over, and that wouldn't have taken long to do it, but it's best that you don't know why.
Because it doesn't matter.
And you don't know why in the very first Halloween Michael Myers is attacking these random kids in Haddonfield. Why'd he go back there? He doesn't know any of these people. Halloween is an hour and a half long. I also bring up Halloween because in a few days it will be Halloween. And that's one of the problems with the modern movies. They think they have to explain everything. Maybe the actors demand more dialogue scenes. One would be better if they just had fewer dialogue scenes, actually. Not that this movie has that much dialogue, really. The biggest dialogue scene in the whole film might be when you've got the Robert F. Kennedy spasmodic dysphonia. That's what Lupita based the red voice on, was RFK Jr.'s
talking like this.
Well, why does RFK talk like that?
I think it's just something he has, or maybe something happened to
his
throat.
Because I have noticed that his voice is very unusual like that.
And she doesn't need to sound like this, really. You said choking before, but she would have gotten over that after a little while. And then it's brought up online. She hasn't spoken in a long time, but then how does she remember anything about language and speaking properly? She should probably have much worse diction then. But we let that go, I guess. And we're bringing it up now because
she sounds cool. Whatever.
Oh, and it's such a great...
So creepy.
The poster of this movie that shows the face being pulled away and beneath it, those huge eyes of Lupita Nyong'o. We've covered her only a few times. 12 Years a Slave, we did as a now playing project. We saw it the night it premiered here in Toronto. It was barely playing anywhere in the world. And we saw it that night. We didn't even mention her name because we didn't know who she was. It was her first ever movie. And she won the Oscar for that. And she, of course, was in Black Panther in a relatively small role. And she's been in the 3 Star Wars movies, but in a special effect kind of thing. So we really haven't seen her on screen that much.
She was in this chess movie.
Well, she's been in other things. But
they, none of them have just been...
Monster hits. Yeah. But she's barely a part of Black Panther. And she's barely a part of the Star Wars films. And when she's in Star Wars, it's not her. It's a special effect. And then Winston Duke hasn't acted that much either. Only 6 movies so far. 3 of them were in the MCU, including Black Panther and then Endgame. And I believe also Infinity War. Yeah, that's the 3 he's been in so far. And then the kids have either never acted before. Well, Shahadi Wright-Joseph, this was her debut. She's also the voice of young Nala in The Lion King. Another huge hit from last year. So a lot of these people crossed over into other big hits either last year or the year before. And then Evan Alex. It's the only movie he's had that's been released so far, at least. Like his suit jams also. So he's wearing the Jaws shirt through a lot of the early part of the film. But then his jammies, basically, is a suit-looking kind of thing. And the Chewbacca mask. Very odd combination of clothes. There's a lot of connections to other films. Of course, Alice in Wonderland, The Rabbits, The Hall of Mirrors, or Looking Glass kind of thing. Connection there, The Red Queen. Obviously, Chud, which is a videotape you see when Adelaide, the human Adelaide, is watching Hands Across America. But also, of course, The Shining.
Yes.
The drive to the vacation house, The Twins, The Murder, all the rest of it.
And when even the twins die, they're in the exact same physical position in the hallway as the flash of the dead twins in The Shining.
Okay, the Grady twins. And then the Goonies, in some ways, the people underground. Mikey has that big speech. Up there, it's their time. Down here, it's our time. But I'm looking forward to what the kids can do in future movies, especially Shahadi Wright Joseph, who is the daughter, and even Winston Duke, not a kid, obviously, but hasn't acted that much yet. And so opposite of what he did in Black Panther. He's so fun and charming and goofy in this movie. Big burly looking dude. And then he's taken out, not completely, because you need him to be in the movie, but you bash his leg with a baseball bat. You won't break it. So he's able to walk, but he's got to stumble and not really be a factor through most of the movie. And that's one reason why, of course, Adelaide has to step up and defend her family, which she truly loves. I mean, they're actually her family, even though she is a clone who's taken the life of somebody else. So Jordan Peele's only directed two films so far. I think he said after he did this movie that everything he ever does is going to be about black people. And there was outrage about that. How dare you? Well, he's making good movies, and what's wrong with that?
There's way more. Plenty of movies about white people.
Yeah, way more than
Don't
that.
Don't worry.
Even black people make movies about white people lots of times.
And in many ways, this movie, unlike Get Out, if you replace the Wilsons with a white family, would it be that different? It would be the same.
It would
movie.
Be no different.
There might be a couple lines you change here and there. You might change the song that they play at the beginning of the film, little touches like that. But for the most part, this is the best kind of casting in the sense, of course, you know they're black. They don't try to pretend that they're culturally white. But it's a movie where their race isn't the main thing about them. The fact that that is refreshing to see, I think, says a lot about the problem with Hollywood only ever wanting to greenlight movies with black actors if them being black is the main point of the film, rather than just allowing them to have stories on their own. There was a spate of films around the turn of the century. You just covered Love and Basketball with Chris.
Well, I talked with him about that. Brown Sugar was a movie that was about black characters. A lot of the same actors.
Wayne Tuxedo, The Best Man, The Wood. They were truly black films, but they just got to have romances and jobs that they cared about.
A lot of them were wealthy, which was nice to see, too.
Yeah, they were middle class. And it seemed like those films either went away or faded off into the background, which is super disappointing because it feels like that's where we need to get. Us is a movie about black people that isn't about them being black.
Well, also, Chris in Get Out is not exactly poor. He's a photographer. He's got a nice apartment.
Yeah, a nice apartment.
And his buddy, Lil Rel Howery, has got a decent job at the TSA.
Yeah, he's a TSA agent.
Right. We haven't sworn yet, so I guess we won't swear right now by quoting that great line at the end when he saves his friend.
Yeah.
Well, I mentioned the big year for some of these actors in 2019 and 2018 in some cases, but Jordan Peele also had a big year last year because this movie came out. It was a monster hit. And he was also a voice in Toy Story 4 last year with his buddy Keegan-Michael Key. They played
so
the two
funny.
Stuffed animals. And Get Out
and
was...
he had Twilight Zone too, which was a huge disappointment.
Yeah, right. And then Get Out was a couple years ago. If you want to look for that podcast, it's way back in our archives. I believe 2017 we covered that one. The producers were Peele himself along with Jason Blum, who did produce Get Out and has been nominated now for two Oscars as a producer. That and Whiplash, one of my favorite movies of the last 10 years or maybe ever, I guess. Blum, of course, made his name with a lot of other horror films, and now he's doing these movies with Peele that are horror in a way, but much deeper than just blood and guts kind of stuff.
Paranormal Activity.
I believe he did that, too. And there's a lot of great subtext.
It's made him a lot of money.
In some of those horror films that have also succeeded because he gives people small budgets. It's like the Roger Corman model. Although in Roger Corman's case, it was, here's $20 to make a movie, or a few thousand, I guess. He's given them a few million, but it's very small budget type stuff. And then look at some of the hits that people have made. Look at Jason Blum's resume as a producer. Not even just as a studio head, but as a producer. And so many of them were monster hits made on very small budgets. In a lot of cases, it made stars, or they got stars to be in their movies, probably for a discounted price, and then the movies really blew up. So that, as a model, that I wish more people would follow.
And doesn't he give them freedom? As long as you stay within budget, you can make any movie
you want. He's doing, in some ways, what Harvey did in the 90s and into the 2000s, except he's not being a tyrant and a bully and a rapist and all the rest of the
As far as we know. Why are you begging for us to find out something terrible about Jason Blum?
The other two producers were Sean McKittrick and Ian Cooper. This was his first movie that he ever produced, period. Movies 2 through 9 to 1, we watched it on Crave. Luckily, it was still on demand for us. We've been screwed by that before, trying to watch a movie, and then Netflix or somebody pulls it off there when we want to watch it. Cinematographer Mike Giulakis, G-I-O-U-Lakis. He's the horror guy because he also shot It Follows, Split, and Glass. Of course, those are Shyamalan films, but all horror thriller-type movies. The editor, Nicholas Mansour, also cut Keanu. Jordan Peele was in that with Keegan-Michael Key. And he also cut some Twilight Zones for Peele. And the composer, Michael Abels. Get Out was his debut score, and he's only done 5 in total. What'd you think of the look, the cutting, and the music of Us?
I actually think the technicals were outstanding. Jordan Peele is a great technical director. It's part of what makes them so watchable. Even the score I loved. I mean, horror films, they do lean on score more than other genres. but I did like it a lot. Maybe it could have been trimmed a little more.
Well, I think the movie is too long.
If I was in the edit suite, I would argue to take out the exposition in the last act.
Yeah, because Red doesn't know these things. She just thinks she knows. And that's fine that a character is speculating on what really happened.
I just don't need to know nitty-gritties about what's going on. But that's neither here nor there. It certainly doesn't ruin the movie for me.
I wonder if in the editing there was a point where the revelation that they were switched was earlier than we saw it. Because I thought for sure...
Could have gone so many places.
It was during the conversation that they have downstairs when Red has stolen Jason and Adelaide is letting the killer speak, just quietly listening rather than, oh, bash you in the head if you don't give him my son.
But the killer breaked from her revolution to cut paper dolls. It's cinematic.
Right. But I thought it was there, but it's actually after all that's taken place and they've gotten away in the ambulance and the Wilsons seem to be safe and free. But then you see it go back to that flashback, that switcheroo. Okay, well, our last horror movie in Scary Movie Month is Us, and your last thoughts on
Us.
Well, this won't be the last time I watch it. I suspect this will be a film I revisit again and again, and talking about it has really made me want to go back and watch Get Out, and I can't wait to see what Peele does next.
That's very true. I look forward to his next few. It's just like Ari Aster with Hereditary.
Mm-hmm.
And even Midsommar.
We've also covered a disappointing follow-up film, but still so interesting and so much to talk about.
We've covered all four films those two guys have directed in their short careers as directors. I don't think I'll watch this one repeatedly through the years, but when I need a reminder of just how clever Peele is, and especially to remind me what Lupita can do, this will be the fix. Because she's really good in 12 Years a Slave, and she's been fine in the other movies. But this is one great performance, playing two different characters. And it's not twins, but in a way, it is. I guess you could call this movie Twins. Or Clones, anyway. No one's called a movie that I'm aware of Clones. That's got to happen at some point,
isn't it?
There's
got to be some B-film somewhere called Clones.
Because there have been so many movies that are about clones. Okay, that's it for us. Us and us. In 7 days, it'll be Election Eve in America, so why not talk about a movie with a very relevant title, The Great Dictator. I'm the best dictator. The best ever. The best. Let's hope to God that's not true anymore day.
Let's use this film to just channel all of our anxieties.
Well, the dictator in this movie is Adolf Hitler. This will be our first Chaplin flick since July 2013, incidentally. And the last time we talked about Chaplin, it was not in any way controversial, but this movie is because he is parodying Adolf Hitler. And that leads me into the coming attractions opinion question. Who played Hitler the best? Was it Chaplin in The Great Dictator? Was it Dick Shawn in The Producers? Was it Noah Taylor in Max, a drama with John Cusack from about 18 or so years ago? Bev is making a look that she doesn't recognize what I'm talking about.
Someone who's never seen that movie.
Was it Taika Waititi in Jojo Rabbit last year? Or was it someone else?
All right, so for the answer to that question, check out our next podcast about The Great Dictator. In the meantime, check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project wherever you listen to us. All of our episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American films ever made, and hundreds more titles on top of that. 365 titles all together, as you said. In exchange for all of this great content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review. If you want to reach us, we're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT, and that's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. It's not case sensitive. And that will get you a 20% discount.
Happy Halloween on Saturday this weekend. Let's hope it'll cancel trick-or-treating. That would be so unfair for someone like me who loves Halloween.
And cut.
And cut. That's very relevant for this episode. Cut.